Volume 3, Chapter 71, The Vermont Revolution, The Green Mountain Boys. While the American colonies were moving inexorably toward a final break with Great Britain, and the winds of revolutionary doctrine blew in from overseas, a local but intense revolutionary conflict was developing in the North. As in the case of so many internal conflicts in the American colonies, the struggles centered around the disposition of land. Western New Hampshire, now Vermont, though still sparsely populated, was being settled throughout the 1760s. Under land grants parceled out by New Hampshire's governor, Benning Wentworth. And these lands quickly devolved by purchase upon the actual settlers. To attract settlers, the prices charged for the land were not very onerous. But New York, goaded by its land speculators, aggressively continued to assert its own arbitrary claims to all the land of the region. In 1771, this western region, which also included part of current New York east of the Hudson, contained some 7,000 settlers. In 1764, however, the Board of Trade dealt a rude blow to the settlers of western New Hampshire. It decreed that New York's land claims to the area were valid. New York's governor, Cadwallader Colden, hastened to proclaim his rights and, true to the New York tradition of venal land oligarchy, to sell those rights to the land to a handful of land speculators from New York. By the end of 1765, Colden had sold to a few speculators rights to 36,000 acres of the best land in the area, centered around Arlington and Manchester in what is now southwestern Vermont. Leading these speculators were James Duane and John T. Kemp. New Hampshire tried desperately to halt or nullify these grants, but the Crown's pressure left enough loopholes for New York to continue granting western New Hampshire land on a large scale. By the late 1760s, Colden had sold over 535,000 acres in grants, and had sold well over 2.1 million acres of military land grants to veterans, virtually all of which were transferred to large land speculators. By 1776, the total had reached 2.1 million acres of regular and 2.4 million acres of military land granted by New York. The great New York oligarchs were featured on this new gravy train of land monopoly. Among the grantees were James Duane, Philip Skeen, William Livingston, Robert R. Livingston, Pierre de Peyster, Augustus Van Cortlandt, William Smith, and John Morin Scott. Claims mean little unless enforced, and the trouble began as soon as New York tried to oust the New Hampshire settlers in behalf of its newly asserted owners. In 1769, New York's aged Cadwallader Colden, back as governor after a three-year gap, brought proceedings against James Breckinridge of Bennington to try to eject him from his farm. When they arrived at the farm, the New York authorities were driven off by armed friends of Breckinridge. The next step was for New York to order the arrest of Breckinridge and his rioting friends, who were led by the Reverend Jebediah Dewey and Samuel Robinson. New York was not able to make any arrest, however, and Colden, with mounting horror, complained that these settlers of the Green Mountain area proclaimed their allegiance to New Hampshire, as if they would hasten to salute a New York power that was trying its best to seize their lands and turn them over to a few privileged favorites. The following year, New York proceeded again in earnest, launching ejectment suits against Breckinridge, Isaiah Carpenter, and other Green Mountain settlers. At this point, one of the great figures of American Revolutionary history emerged, to be chosen to lead the defense of the beleaguered settlers, the redoubtable Ethan Allen. The trial of Breckinridge, Carpenter, and others took place in the New York courts. The impartiality of the court may be gauged by the fact that its chief justice was Robert R. Livingston himself, a leading New York grantee of New Hampshire land. And the prosecutors were Attorney General Kemp and James Duane, the leaders of the speculative ring in the granted land. Not surprisingly, the New York court ruled for New York in June 1770. At first, Duane and Kemp tried to bribe Ethan Allen into submission, but the latter scornfully rejected their offer. Allen and the settlers resolved to hold their positions by force if necessary. Banding together, the settlers formed a committee of safety to oppose the court's decision, as well as an armed band to resist New York's aggression against their properties. The band was called the Green Mountain Boys, and Ethan Allen was chosen its leader. Soon each town west of the mountains had selected its own committee of safety. Delegates from the local committees convened regularly at Bennington. Moving from attempted bribery to physical violence, the New York government, now headed by its ever more grasping governor, Lord Dunmore, sent sheriffs several times to arrest Breckinridge, but each time they were violently repelled by armed farmers of the neighborhood. New York responded by escalating its coercion, ordering the arrest of the rioters, including the leaders, Silas Robinson and Simon Hathaway. The farmers refused to be intimidated, and violent armed defense continued. The Vermont region is bisected by the Green Mountains. Although the heart of the settler resistance was located west of the mountains, the eastern region erupted also. There, while the Breckinridge turmoil continued in the west, a band of armed settlers, headed by Joseph and Benjamin Waite and by Nathan and Samuel Stone, rebelled against New York authority, denied its jurisdiction, captured the sheriff who had tried to arrest them, and forced the New York courts to adjourn. But the revolutionary movement there did not command the mass support that it did west of the Green Mountains. For the eastern side was more remote, and New York's yoke was felt more lightly there. The town of Guilford even went so far as ardently to advocate allegiance to New York. Rioters were therefore routed by 400 pro-New York inhabitants, and the settler revolution was stilled in eastern Vermont by the end of 1770. But in the west, the revolutionary struggle intensified. From defending the property of Breckinridge and the other settlers, the rebels went on the offensive to oust by force all New York authority in the area. When New York appointed a pliant ally as judge, the judge's home was burned down, and he was driven off. Robert Cochran led an armed band and forced out of the territory two leading New York officials. Surveyors from New York were threatened and beaten, and their surveying tools confiscated. Settler defense continued as well. When the New York sheriff put a tenant of his in place of Isaiah Carpenter on the latter's farm, Carpenter's neighbors forced the intruder to leave. The New York government next tried the soft sell, wooing the angry settlers by promising to confirm their grants from New Hampshire and reduce official fees. But the settlers could no longer trust their enemy, and so New York, now led by Governor William Tryon, fresh from his triumph in crushing the North Carolina regulation, soon returned to the policy of coercion. In July 1771, Sheriff Henry Ten Eyck gathered a huge posse, numbering in the hundreds, at Bennington, in the southwest corner of Vermont, to bar Breckinridge from his farm. Now at last these insolent rebels were to be taught the lesson of obedience. Setting out confidently on their easy mission, the New York posse was ambushed, surrounded, and forced back by a heroic band of ardent revolutionaries, members of the Green Mountain Boys, led by Captains Robert Cochran and Seth Warner, a cousin of Ethan Allen. This stirring victory of a private band of irregulars over organized New York power raised the hearts and spirits of the settlers of western New Hampshire. The Green Mountain Boys now launched a systematic campaign to drive off the settlers who had been brought in by New York to enjoy the property created by the New Hampshire settlers. Charles Hutchinson, a transplanted New Yorker on Cochran's property, saw his cabin burned and was ordered off by Ethan Allen. "Go your way now and complain to that damned scoundrel, your governor. God damn your governor, laws, king, council, and assembly." Governor Tryon of New York, in consequence, offered a reward for the capture of Allen, Cochran, and another leader, remember Baker, to which Allen and the Green Mountain Boys retorted sardonically by offering counter-rewards for the capture of their arch-enemies, Duane and Kemp. In high spirits, Allen wrote mockingly to Philip Skeen that, by virtue of a late law in the province, they are not allowed to hang any man before they have kitched him. Boldly, Allen rode into Albany unharmed and was welcomed by a sympathetic populace. Allen did not even let himself be fazed by the desertion of the Green Mountain cause by the New Hampshire authorities. By the end of 1771, Governor John Wentworth of New Hampshire had abandoned support of the rebels, hoping indeed to acquire some of the New York-claimed land for himself. The best the settlers could now hope for from New Hampshire was neutrality, which they gained when Wentworth refused to issue a proclamation against the Green Mountain Boys. The Green Mountain Boys now stood alone. How could these very loosely organized and individualistic irregulars hope to stand up to the overwhelming might of the New York government, backed by British regular troops? The answer lies in the authentic genius of the undaunted Ethan Allen. Allen perceived the potential of a new form of warfare on the scene of world history. Allen had watched with interest and sympathy the Prendergast Tenant Rebellion of 1766 and the rapid debacle of the rebel cause. From this carnage, Allen and Allen alone learned the proper military and revolutionary lessons. Allen saw that the grave mistake of Prendergast and the Tenants was to rush out, an unorganized and untrained mass, to do formal battle with the well-trained and far more heavily armed British troops. The ensuing slaughter was inevitable. But why must all battle be waged in formal ranks, on open fields? Just because all European military lore said so? Allen did not see why these hidebound rules should not be transcended. In particular, he saw that a revolutionary war, a people's war, was best waged in a far different and a far more revolutionary manner. In brief, what were the advantages and disadvantages of the Green Mountain Boys in their armed struggle with the organized power of New York? Their disadvantages were all too evident. The superior arms and the formally trained, specialized troops of the enemy. But the military advantages of such a zealous people's revolutionary movement had too often been overlooked. Two advantages were that the rebels dwelt among an admittedly friendly and sympathetic population and operated on a thoroughly friendly terrain. As settlers themselves, the rebel forces were of that population and could blend quickly and easily with it. This itself greatly offset the specialization of the enemy. These part-time rebels, so camouflaged, just could not easily be spotted, isolated, or captured. Therefore, able to move among the people and on familiar terrain as fish in water, the rebel band had the great advantage of mobility and speed. It also had the advantage of surprise, for the support of the surrounding populace gave it an enormous intelligence advantage over the enemy. The rebels came to know where the enemy was, but the enemy knew virtually nothing about the rebels. The rebels, therefore, could and must hit and run, strike and fade away, harassing and weakening and demoralizing the enemy while keeping it always off balance. These advantages and others the far-sighted Allen had come to see. In short, he perceived that the proper path to victory for a people's revolution against a well-armed state force is guerrilla warfare, not a foolhardy rush to open confrontation and instant defeat. To organize guerrilla warfare, the rebels needed knowledgeable and brilliant leadership and high morale, both in the fighting force and in the supporting population. The Vermont settlers possessed these requisites in the high-quality leadership of Allen and his lieutenants, and in the zeal of the settlers fighting for their homes and land against aggressors. By 1772, a successful and continuing guerrilla war was being waged in the Green Mountains. The astuteness and farsightedness of Ethan Allen's grasp of the principles and tactics of guerrilla war may be seen by his highly restrained use of coercion, since it is crucial to the success of a revolution to keep the active support of the masses. Coercion must be held to the necessary minimum, both for daily mass support and so as not to provoke enemy reprisals against the people. Therefore, only as necessary, and then but minimally, were threats and terror employed by the Green Mountain Boys in achieving their aims of driving out the New York officials and interlopers, and of rescuing settlers and their own members from the New York enemy. So remarkable was their minimizing of coercion that in all their battles and skirmishes, the Green Mountain Boys never killed a single man. Allen sensed that revolutionary practice cannot successfully proceed without revolutionary theory, and he proceeded to supply the latter as well. Lusty, militant, candid, and rough-hewn, Allen may have been, but he was far from an unlettered oaf. Though lacking a college education, Allen studied at the feet of the notable Boston radical Dr. Thomas Young. From Young, Allen imbibed deism, Newton, and French rationalism. Allen used his ardently held Lockean natural rights theory to justify the settler revolution. In his Brief Narrative, 1774, written at the behest of a convention of West Side towns, Allen rested the settlers' rights to their land on the Lockean natural right of possession and cultivation, which is of itself abundantly sufficient to maintain the right in the possessor, and to gain him a title sealed and confirmed with the sweat and toil of the farmer. In short, as Darlene Shapiro puts it, Allen's argument, then, is that he who occupies and works the land has a natural right to it, a right sufficient to confer legality. In true Lockean fashion, Allen proceeded to demonstrate the limits of government. Laws and society, compacts, were made to protect and secure the subjects in their peaceable possessions and properties, and not to subvert them. No person or community of persons can be supposed to be under any particular compact of law, except it presupposeth that the law will protect such person or community of persons in his or their properties. Therefore, no government or king may force a man to give up his rightful property. The supreme power cannot take from any man any part of his property without his own consent. When a government transcends its proper limits and invades private property, then power reverts to the people, who resume their original liberty. In this way, reasoned Allen, the settlers of western New Hampshire had returned to a state of nature. By the default of the governments of New York, New Hampshire, and Great Britain, the Green Mountain Boys had become the means by which the settlers assumed the task of defending their property. Governor Tryon, the stern extirpator of the Regulators, had never encountered such opponents as the Green Mountain Boys. In the spring of 1772, he asked for negotiations, although he refused to talk with the top leaders. The rebels sent as negotiators Captain Stephen Fay, the veteran tavern keeper of Bennington, where the rebels often gathered, and his son, Dr. Jonas Fay. In the rebel messages to Tryon, it was trenchantly pointed out who the real rioters and wielders of violence were. Though they, the sheriff and posse, style us rioters for opposing them and seek to catch and punish us as such, yet in reality themselves are the rioters, the tumultuous, disorderly faction, or in fine, the land jobbers. A lull now appeared in the New York conflict. In the West, the governor obeyed royal orders to leave the New Hampshire settlers alone. In the East, the revolutionary spirit died down. Guilford formally proclaimed itself part of New York, and two pro-Yorkers were elected to the New York Assembly. Tryon and the Fays readily concluded a truce on the basis of letting the settlers alone. But the Vermont lull was destined to be short-lived. Continued pressure by Yorkers on western New Hampshire lands led to determined armed resistance by the rebels. Full-scale conflict resumed more intensely than ever, and a futile arrest order was sent out for Remember Baker and Ira Allen. Governor Tryon vainly asked for British troops to crush the Green Mountain Boys, but the British wanted no repetition of their role in suppressing the New York Tenant Rebellion of 1766. During 1773, guerrilla terrorism by the Boys intensified. The major irritant was the Scottish Colonel John Reed, a New York land claimant who had been ejected from his claimed land by the settlers a year before. In early 1773, Reed led a party of Scottish immigrants back to settle on the invaded land. He built a wall and even began to construct a village on the land. But in mid-August, Ethan Allen, Baker, and Seth Warner, leading 100 Green Mountain Boys, swept down to demolish this nascent settlement and to drive the intruders off the land. When asked by a settler for his legal warrant for this raid, Baker lifted his hand to a declaim, "Here is my warrant," and Allen then raised his rifle high and dramatically shouted, "This is my law." As the guerrilla war continued to rage, Ethan Allen and his band in the autumn of 1773 kidnapped one of New York's top officials in the area, Judge Benjamin Spencer. Allen, Cochran, Warner, and Baker then conducted a public trial of Spencer, finding him guilty of allegiance to New York at the expense of the settlers. Allen and Baker informed Spencer that they valued not the government of New York, nor even the kingdom. They had force and power sufficient to protect themselves against either. As punishment, Spencer's roof was pulled off. After this salutary warning, Spencer pledged himself to be a loyal citizen of New Hampshire thenceforth. Thus was a leading royal official in the western area mildly but firmly removed from the fray. The request of the unhappy Tryon for British troops was again scornfully turned down. General Frederick Haldimand in Boston, a Prussian-trained officer totally unfamiliar with Allen's new-style guerrilla warfare, indignantly wondered how Tryon could possibly claim to need His Majesty's troops to vanquish a few miserable bandits. Finally, Governor Tryon moved to a stance of maximum toughness, violating the canons of Anglo-Saxon law in the process. In early March 1774, he put through the New York legislature the Bloody Law, which proclaimed that Allen, Warner, Baker, Cochran, Breckinridge, and three other Green Mountain Boys were to be regarded as convicted felons and were to suffer death without trial unless they surrendered themselves within 70 days. Rewards for the capture of these leaders were also greatly increased. In the face of this awesome sentence of outlawry, Ethan Allen never faltered. Instead, he leaped to counterattack in a magnificently revolutionary manner. In a slashing remonstrance, Allen blasted the New York officials of insatiable, avaricious, overbearing, inhuman, barbarous, blood-guiltiness of disposition and intention. Allen dared the New Yorkers to come and get the Green Mountain Boys. Come on, we are ready for a game of scalping with them, for our martial spirits glow with bitter indignation and consummate fury to blast their infernal projections. Allen concluded with sweeping counter-death threats, promising death to anyone who dared to arrest a single Green Mountain Boy. And a West Side Convention of Settlers in mid-April branded any person in the area holding a commission from New York an enemy to their country. New York was stunned to find maximum threats answered in kind. No one surrendered, and the Green Mountain Boys redoubled beatings and insults to New York officials and transplants, and they proceeded to seize, try, and sentence the New Yorkers. Acting Governor Colden, replacing Tryon, who had been called to England to explain this curious phenomenon in the New Hampshire Grant area, soon was forced to call again for British troops, which were again sternly denied. Meanwhile, the East Siders, those east of the Green Mountains, were being galvanized by the passage of the Coercive Acts and the British crackdown on Massachusetts. The East Side met at a Cumberland County Convention in Westminster late in October to consider its course. The East Siders replied rather ambivalently, if unsurprisingly, hailing American liberty and devotion to the King. Going beyond this stance, Leonard Spaulding of Dummerston cursed King George for establishing the Roman Catholic Church in Canada so vehemently that he was arrested for high treason. Soon armed men gathered and marched to Westminster, freeing Spaulding without meeting any resistance. The town clerk of Dummerston hailed this liberating act by the brave Sons of Freedom and concluded his account of the affair by denouncing the cutthroatly, Jacobitish, high church, tyrannical minions of George III, the Pope of Canada and tyrant of Britain. No conservative hanging back or ambiguity here. The West Siders, always leading in the revolution, were not to be caught napping. After the removal of Benjamin Spencer, the Baptist minister, Judge Benjamin Huff was the only major New York official remaining in the area. Finally, at the end of January 1775, Huff was seized by the Green Mountain Boys and taken to Sunderland to be tried by the leaders of the rebels. Huff was charged with allegiance to New York and acting as a New York magistrate. Admitting the charges, Huff was sentenced by the judges to 200 lashes with a rope scourge and exiled from the New Hampshire Grant area. Before sending Huff out on foot, Allen and Warner capped their triumph by issuing the judge a passport for safe conduct to New York. Thus, Ethan Allen had led the Green Mountain Boys in 5 years of outstandingly successful guerrilla war against mighty New York to a smashing conclusion. In sum, New York officials and planted settlers had been ejected from the area, and New Hampshire settlers had been defended, with no one killed on either side during the entire period. Indeed, only one Green Mountain Boy was wounded, and a few New Yorkers were whipped, pushed around, and had their homes burned. The full catalog of casualties of this remarkable conflict under a remarkable and brilliant leader. Matters were also coming to a head on the east side of the Green Mountains. A convention of Cumberland County had endorsed the actions of the First Continental Congress. Non-importation, however, was rejected by the New York Assembly, thus widening further the rift with the East Side. A third county convention in early February petitioned Governor Colden against the tyranny of the county court, which was appointed from above rather than chosen by the people of the county. Moreover, the court was too expensive and burdensome. It inconveniently dragged local farmers in to sit on juries and was too prompt in enforcing collection of debts. Despite warnings of approaching tension, the Cumberland County Court opened on March 13. A group of about 100 men met at Rockingham, north of the county seat at Westminster, and, armed only with clubs, marched down to the county courthouse and engaged in a sit-in. That evening, marching up from the south, came Sheriff Billy Patterson, at the head of 50 men, many of them equipped with firearms. That night, the sheriff's posse shot its way into the courthouse and killed two of the sit-ins in what soon was dubbed the Westminster Massacre. The first one to die was young William French, who was fittingly saluted as the martyr of the fray. The Westminster Massacre aroused and galvanized the people of the East Side New Hampshire Grants. The following day, militia companies of the people formed and kept tramping into Westminster. The Patterson posse hastened to flee. The county court, reading the handwriting on the wall, hastily adjourned. The radical elements in the assembled mob proposed to burn the courthouse and shoot the sheriff, the judges, and all their retinue, but they were held back by the more restrained militia commanders. Instead, the militiamen released the sit-in prisoners and arrested the sheriff, judges, county clerk, and members of the posse that could be rounded up. As militiamen continued to pour into Westminster to fend off any New Yorker or British counterattack, a climactic moment came when there arrived from across the mountains a detachment of Green Mountain Boys, led by Captain Robert Cochrane. Their arrival was a living symbol of the emerging unity between the two halves of the New Hampshire Grant Territory. As usually happens in such cases, the postponement of revolutionary vengeance led to a cooling off of temper and resolution. The Yorkite prisoners were either released on bond or sent for trial to Massachusetts, where they were all soon released. Not one of the Yorkers implicated in the massacre even came to trial. However, the generally hated Justice Noah Sabin, on returning to his farm, was treated by his fellow citizens with an intense wrath that stopped just short of invading another man's sacred right of private property. Sabin was assured that should he take one step beyond the borders of his own farm, he would be shot that instant. Unity between the East Side and the West Side was further forged on April 11, when a convention of the town committees of safety of the two regions assembled at Westminster and proclaimed that all citizens should wholly renounce and resist the oppressive jurisdiction of the government of New York. Two East Siders and Ethan Allen were selected to draw up a remonstrance on their joint behalf. As the news arrived of the shattering events at Lexington and Concord, the sturdy and successful Vermont Revolution naturally blended into the revolution against Great Britain. For one thing, the enemy New York government, particularly its executive, was a royal government, as was that of New Hampshire. For another, the call of liberty against the oppression of the state was very familiar to the men of the Green Mountains. They had fought for the libertarian cause for years. What more natural than to extend the fighting against the larger despotism of Imperial Britain?